The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with a short story from the fiction section of the June 7, 2021 issue of the New Yorker magazine. Before the Valley by Rachel Hing. The candles were already lit when Hui Bin arrived. Her mistake. She'd missed the announcement at breakfast saying today's party would take place in the big hall instead of in the rec room. What was wrong with the rec room? She mentally complained while taking her place in the crowd. Birthday celebrations were always in the rec room, but catching a glimpse of pot-bellied Kirpal in his wheelchair, Hui Bin softened. Likely the change had been made because Kirpal was so popular and more residents than usual were expected to attend. Typically, birthdays were local affairs. Hui Bin was in Ward 4, one of the 14-bed wards, which was a bad thing every day of the year except her birthday, when it meant that she could count on at least 13 other people showing up to her party. A relief, since Hui Bin had never been good at making friends, even before. Before was the shorthand residents used for their lives prior to Sunrise Valley. Before wasn't talked about often. It felt unseemly somehow, self-indulgent to dwell on one's past life. What did it matter? For example, that Cynthia from Ward 8 had been an actress who starred in the horror films that used to be made here in Singapore back in the 60s. Or that Hazmi from Ward 12 had been a lawyer and was even rumored to have owned his own firm. They were all here now, Sunrise Valley residents one and the same. Sure, Cynthia was in a two-bedder with a garden view, and Hazmi had one of the few coveted and very expensive single wards. They still had to come to the linoleum-tiled dining room each morning for the same soggy kaya toast and watered-down coffee. Still, took their seats each evening in front of the television, which blared alternately English, Chinese, Malay, and Tamil language soaps. Wards aside, were the residents not all in the same boat? The details might differ. Mild dementia, children too busy to visit, loss of leg function, no living relatives, but the crux of the matter was the same. You were stuck in Sunrise Valley, regardless, whether it was paid for by your dwindling pension, the government, or an erstwhile child. Of course, Cynthia and Hazmi would disagree. Those in the smaller wards were most likely to let slip details of their befores. Nothing too obvious, just a hint here, an old business card there, because they couldn't bear being lumped in with everyone else. Hui Bin understood. Once, she, too, would have bristled at the thought of sitting among strangers in the dining room that smelled like a hospital, eating from childish plastic bowls. But you got used to it. And if you didn't, well, some didn't. A scuffle broke out to Hui Bin's left, and then a wail. "Shh, Hazel, never mind. Let her have it. Shh, okay, okay. She'll give it back to you." The aide fussed and soothed, but Hazel's cries only grew louder. The nature of the offense? Her neighbor had snatched the graying stuffed rabbit that Hazel carried everywhere. "Bow bow," she called it. One of the few words she still spoke. Baby. Even with the rabbit restored to her, Hazel continued to storm, flailing at her neighbor's face as if she were a nightmare to be banished. Hui Bin averted her gaze. Seeing Hazel like this made something open up inside her, a frightening abyss she had to carefully ignore or risk falling into. Just a year ago, Hazel had sat with them in the common dining hall, carrying on entire conversations, eating on her own and complaining loudly about the food. "Curry as thin as my diarrhea," Hui Bin remembered her saying once when they were seated at the same table. Back then, Hazel's eyes had been bright and impish, her wispy white hair neatly pulled back with a shiny red clip. "You got diarrhea?" Hazel had asked. Hui Bin shook her head. "Lucky you." Hazel had had mild dementia then. Many of them did, and still lived happily with everyone else. But 6 months later, she had disappeared from the dining room. "Hi, D," the others whispered, shaking their heads. And then they spoke of Hazel no more. No one liked to talk about the high dependency residents who lived on the third floor. Stroke victims, the paralyzed or severely incapacitated, the self-harming, and, on rare occasions, those who had lost all hope and simply refused to eat or move. There was a special ward in High D for those with advanced dementia, and that was where Hazel lived now. High D residents were always in wheelchairs and wore large, pillowy gloves that looked like oven mitts. With her teeth, Hazel now tore off a glove and flung it in the aide's face. "Take her out, please," Mrs. Tan called from the front of the room, where the candles for Kirpal were slowly burning down. Mrs. Tan spoke in what Hui Bin called her weekend voice, the warm, syrupy tone she assumed on Saturdays and Sundays when Sunrise Valley teemed with families and visitors. Her usual voice was rigid and cold, often crackling with impatience. One understood, Hui Bin thought. As the floor manager responsible for some 20 wards and more than 100 residents, Mrs. Tan could not be saying please and thank you in her weekend voice all the time, or nothing would ever get done. But today was Wednesday. Could it be? Hui Bin craned her neck to see the front of the room. Sure enough, a tall, slender young woman stood beside Kirpal's wheelchair, one hand on his shoulder.
"Okay, Dadaji, we sing now?"
The woman smiled, and the smile lit up her lovely face. Her throat was like an egret's, long and graceful and smooth. She put one hand to it now.
"Indian girls, when pretty, always so pretty," Al Gal from Ward 5 said.
He spoke in Hokkien.
"Pervert,"
Hui Bin hissed back.
"Say only. Say also cannot."
"Shh."
"Kirpal, always say... Satfir this, Satfir that, Satfir so smart, Satfir the most pretty."
"Are you Satfir's grandfather?"
"Happy birthday to you, happy birthday to you."
Al Gal and Hui Bin were drowned out by the singing, a dissonant chorus of residents' voices slipping in and out of sync. Mrs. Tan led the song in English, and the residents sang along in whatever version they knew. Al Gal began singing in Mandarin, Hui Bin, rather proudly in English. She liked any chance to practice. Hui Bin was born the youngest child of seven, at a time when her older siblings were already working, and thus, despite her father's having been a karanguni, rag-and-bone man, and her mother a laundry woman, she'd been afforded the rare luxury of school. After attending the convent school up to Form 6, and even learning a few words of French, she'd gone on to take a typing class and got a job as a secretary at a small shipping company. Eventually, she'd had to leave, of course, once she married and had her children. But how many of the women of Sunrise Valley could say that they'd once read Le Petit Prince to a roomful of elegant Brits at the Raffles Hotel? In hindsight, Hui Bin saw how shamelessly she'd been used by the convent nuns to raise funds for the school, trotted out at charity galas and school fairs like a prize pig. Never would she have allowed her own child to be paraded in this way. And yet those golden evenings, filled with the scent of cut roses withering in tropical heat, the gloved hands of wealthy women cupping her chin, the applause and admiration... they would stay with her always.
"Happy birthday to Kirpal, happy birthday to you."
The room broke out into cheers. Cameras flashed. Kripal, however, was covering his face.
"Don't take photo. You said no photo," he growled.
Silence fell. Kripal was never tense. Known for his dirty chokes and the endless supply of M&Ms he doled out from his pockets, even to the diabetics, he was usually the life of any party, the one to brighten so many of their gloomy afternoons. Everyone had a Kripal story. Hui Bin herself had met him on her very first day at Sunrise Valley. Her daughter had just left. It was tea time. Hui Bin's few belongings, a Bible, eyeglasses, and some laminated photos, had been tucked away in a cabinet by her bed. She still remembered the terrible loneliness of walking into that dining hall for the first time, meeting the roomy eyes that looked up at her from their cartons of Milo and chrysanthemum tea. Everyone was so old, so old. And yet they looked like children, with their paper bibs and dribbling mouths and meaningless gurgles. Oh, it was horrifying. Surely she did not look like that. Surely she did not eat like that, sit like that. She had to call her daughter, she thought in a panic. She could not stay there. And then came the awful realization. Even if she did call Doreen, all her daughter would say was what she always said. "There's no other option. It's just not safe. What if you fall again?" Hui Bin would take falling again over this dining hall, these poor specimens hunched in their chairs, napping in their tea. Then a loud wolf whistle broke her spiral.
"Who's the new hottie?"
It was said with such a plum that, to Hui Bin's surprise, she began to laugh. The wolf whistler beckoned to the empty seat next to him. As soon as she sat down, Hui Bin began to feel better. Kripal had a way of looking at you, eyes half shut, challenging tilt in the chin, humorous twist to the mouth, as if to say, "Now, just look at what we have here." Something about him made you sit up in your seat and want to prove yourself. In a place where people came to die, you felt, for lack of a better word, alive. Along with his ribald cheer, Kripal gave off an aura of no-nonsense pragmatism, a fatalistic acceptance of the situation, such as it was. He could calm any high-D resident, lift the spirits of any frightened newcomer. In the months that followed, Hui Bin learned that Kripal welcomed every new face, man or woman, hearing or otherwise, upright or wheelchair-bound, with the loudest wolf whistle he could muster. So it made them all uneasy to see Kripal cover his face now, snapping at his beautiful granddaughter who had come all this way on a Wednesday afternoon, and perhaps even taken time off work to visit him. Not many residents had granddaughters who would do such a thing, buy helium balloons, hire a professional photographer, all just for a birthday, when birthdays were a dime a dozen around here.
"Dadaji, it's okay, I stand next to you," Satvir said.
Finally, Kripal acquiesced. But even Satvir's dazzling smile could not compensate for the stony look he directed at the camera. Flash, flash, flash. The photographer took out a small electronic device, one that looked like a Walkman, and pointed at Kripal's closed mouth. Satvir chattered away brightly. Hui Bin caught fragments from where she was sitting.
"My Dadaji is a man with a rare gift. My Dadaji has a true work ethic. My Dadaji would take me to the beach."
And so on. If it had been anyone else's granddaughter, Hui Bin might have found the way the girl was going on a little exaggerated, even mildly irritating. But it was natural to feel enthusiastic about a grandfather like Kripal.
"Reporter," Al Gao said, gesturing toward the photographer, "from the Singapore Tribune."
"Don't talk nonsense," Hui Bin said.
"Not nonsense. I heard from Cynthia. Arranged by his granddaughter. Big interview."
"Heard from Cynthia means true?" At that moment, cake was distributed, and Hui Bin didn't press further. They tucked in, rainbow sprinkles sticking to the corners of Al Gao's mouth, Hui Bin's fingers growing oily from the grease that seeped through her paper plate. Strawberry icing and sponge dissolved in a cloying paste on her tongue as Korean pop music, the aide's favorite, streamed from the radio. The residents chewed quietly. At the front of the room, Satfir was still speaking animatedly into the reporter's tape recorder. Her elegant arm was slung protectively around Kirpal, who said nothing and refused to take his eyes off his lap, where a slice of strawberry cake sat untouched on its plate. Breakfast the next morning was nasi lemak, Hui Bin's favorite. The fried chicken wings might be soggy, and the peanuts low in salt, but the rice itself was soft and fragrant, with the rich scent of coconut milk. And the belacan was always good, extra spicy, and not too sweet. Hui Bin carefully arranged each bite just how she liked it. A spoonful of rice, a morsel of egg dabbed with belacan, a piece of chicken. As she began to eat, Kirpal rolled up in his wheelchair.
"Good," he said. "Mind if I join you?"
She nodded. Hui Bin was in the habit of coming early to meals so as to avoid the awkward sting of solitude. Kirpal, on the other hand, typically arrived late, surrounded by his rotating posse. She'd never seen him come to breakfast at this time before. If she were Algal or Cynthia, she might have questioned him about it, but being herself, she just went on making neat, delicious mouthfuls of nasi lemak. Kirpal didn't speak either. He ate slowly, his eyes fixed on the empty space between their trays. There they sat, fluorescent lights flickering overhead, the smell of fried chicken mingling with that of the lemony antiseptic cleaner used to wipe down the tables. The longer the silence went on, the less Hui Bin was able to enjoy her nasi lemak. The chicken seemed oilier than usual, the rice overcooked. "Did you have a good birthday?" she said at last. Kirpal looked up. Over the whites of his eyes crept a fine spider web of pink blood vessels. He seemed not to be thinking of his birthday at all. He had, Hui Bin thought with a shiver, the air of a defeated man. "Lovely," he said at last. More silence.
"Did you like the cake?"
A faint note of desperation entered her voice. Suddenly, she thought of an afternoon many years ago. Doreen coming home from school to find her sitting motionless at the dining table, while Lisa, barely 6 months old then, screamed in the next room. Children have an uncanny instinct for their parents' pain, Hui Bin remembered thinking, as she watched Doreen's face change. The girl didn't yet know that her father had left, in the most humiliatingly cliched of ways, for a woman he kept up in Johor Bahru. Didn't yet know that Hui Bin feared not being able to find a job. Didn't yet know that they might lose the flat in which they lived. But Doreen took one look at her mother and seemed instantly to acquire a maturity she had not had that morning. She poured her mother a glass of water, setting it down on the table before her with such care that it broke Hui Bin's heart. Then she went to calm the baby. Soon, the flat was quiet again. Hui Bin took a sip of water and felt that she might go on. "Yes," Kirpal said, "it was delicious." It took Hui Bin a moment to realize that he was answering her question about the cake. The silence that fell again was unbearable. Were their roles reversed? Were she burdened by some private grief? Kirpal would surely have known how to comfort her.
"Your granddaughter is very beautiful," she said, "and so filial. Sweet of her to come yesterday."
Kirpal didn't answer, but instead cupped the bottom half of his face with his hands. His knuckles were enormous, as twisted and shiny as oiled walnuts. His fingernails, impeccably clean, made small white smiles against his skin.
"She's still working at Procter & Gamble? Young people these days work so hard. My Lisa, she does advertising in New York, so long hours and doesn't even pay well. Doreen, also, every day work until 8 o'clock, no time to eat dinner. She's still single, you know, 48 years old. I worry,
Does she want to be alone forever? But you know how they are. As Kripal remained silent, Hui Bin continued to spout meaningless chatter, even though she knew that she was somehow saying the wrong thing, that she was making it all worse, was turning the blade of some invisible knife between his ribs.
Oi, Kripal!
It was Ao Gao, shuffling in excitedly on his walker. Gratefully, Hui Bin stopped mid-sentence. In his armpit, Ao Gao gripped a newspaper. No doubt it would be damp and a little smelly. Still, she was relieved for his presence, even when he spread the newspaper out on the table in front of them and it was dark with sweat stains.
Look! Wao Gao jabbed a finger at the page repeatedly. Wah! Famous Lei Yu!
There they were, Kripal and Satfir, he in his wheelchair, she leaning protectively over his shoulder. Around them were the colorful balloons she'd brought. On a table in the background was the cream cake studded with slices of strawberry. But it wasn't the balloons or the cake or even Kripal that Hui Bin was looking at. It was the words, those strange, incomprehensible words marching across the top of the photograph about Sapphire's smiling face and her long, cascading hair, printed as simply as if they formed any ordinary headline. Retired hangman celebrates 90th birthday. Beneath it, in smaller font, former state executioner was known for his affable nature.
What does it say? Ao Gao asked in Hoi Kien. What does it say?
Attracted by his loud voice, some of his ward mates had come over with their trays of nasi lemak. They crowded around the newspaper, pointing and exclaiming.
Why never interview me? One asked in Cantonese. Wah, Kripal, famous like Cynthia, you also a movie star?
Another said in Malay.
What?
Algo spoke slowly in English now, enunciating each word. What does it say? They were all staring at Hui Bin, mouths hanging open like hungry, slobbering dogs. Kripal, too, raised his heavy-lidded eyes to meet hers. She tried to see it in his face, the man who, for decades, had made a living taking the lives of others. She stared at his large knuckled hands that lay open on the table, palms as smooth as the inside of a seashell, from which she had so often accepted M&Ms and high fives. He saw her looking. Slowly he brought his hands together as if to pray.
Go on, Hui Bin, Kripal said.
He spoke gently, in English, as intimately as if they were husband and wife. Tell them what it says. Some weeks later, Doreen took Hui Bin out for the day. The aides insisted on pushing her to Doreen's car in a wheelchair. You know it's all for show, right? Hui Bin said, as soon as the car door was closed. They let me walk around any old how when you're not here.
I'm sure that's not true, her daughter replied primly. If that's true, then why am I paying them so much?
Not that much, Hui Bin thought. She was in a 14-bed ward, after all. But if she said that, Doreen would only start complaining about Lisa, living it up in New York with no thought for her mother and her responsibilities.
Where do you want to go?
Hui Bin shrugged. Doreen drove them to the nearest mall, but because it was Saturday, the underground car park was choked with crawling vehicles looking for a space and ambling families trying to remember where they had parked. Doreen and Hui Bin went around in slow, frustrating circles for almost half an hour. The air conditioning in the car was broken, and something rattled in the engine each time Doreen accelerated.
You should get that fixed.
We've got money. When it finally conks, I'll just sell it for junk and take the MRT like everyone else.
Hui Bin pinched her nose. Doreen knew very well that her mother couldn't go on the MRT. The escalators went too fast. Their steps were too steep. The train doors that opened and shut didn't allow enough time. These day trips would end, too, then. Finally, they found an empty space. Doreen backed the car into it with jerky, aggressive turns. Hui Bin's daughters had always been tightly wound, but she seemed to be getting worse of late. Hui Bin wondered about her life. Was she not lonely? Didn't she want a family of her own? Though, in truth, Hui Bin knew very well the reason for Doreen's solitude. And after her father vanished, she'd built her walls carefully, painstakingly, as only a child knew how, so that no errant gap would let in the light of pain. And now here she was, living on her own, working days and nights, and often weekends, so busy she had time to see no one, not even her own mother. But Hui Bin didn't actually know that. Possibly, Doreen kept strings of lovers, held dinner parties with her school friends, was a regular social butterfly. Perhaps she had a husband, a child even. An entire life kept secret, like the one her father had once had with his second family across the causeway. His blood ran in her veins. Just because Hui Bin had always taken Doreen at her word didn't mean that it was a true. They made their way to Toast Box in the basement of the mall. A long line snaked from the counter, and it seemed as though the parking situation would repeat itself.
Kopi o gao? Sweet dye? Right? Want any toast? Doreen said, joining the line.
Hui Bin shook her head and went off with her walker to find them a seat. She hovered between two tables, each occupied by a couple who had finished eating but continued to sit silently, scrolling on their phones. Finally, one of the women brusquely tapped her husband on the elbow, gathered their shopping bags, and left. Hui Bin took a seat. Her shoulders hurt. The cafe was jammed with strollers and screaming babies, toddlers pressing their cheeks to the tiled floor, glossy paper bags filled with shoes and clothes blocking the aisles. The stool Hui Bin sat on was wobbly and had no back. She found herself missing the plastic chairs in Sunrise Valley's dining room, with their cushioned seats and sturdy, curved spines. Nevertheless, when Doreen arrived with the drinks and toast, even though she said that she didn't want toast, Hui Bin started on her usual refrain.
Work very busy?
Busy, yes. My boss just quit, so they're getting me to do all his work. It's a nightmare.
Wah! Promotion?
No, Doreen clicked her tongue impatiently. That's not how it works. You don't just get promoted because... Well, never mind. They drank their coffee. Doreen picked at the kaya toast. It was bothersome how she kept breaking off small pieces and getting the sticky green paste all over her fingers, instead of just picking up the whole thing and eating it properly. But Hui Bin swallowed the admonishment on the tip of her tongue. Her daughter was not 14 anymore.
So busy. Got time to cook dinner every night?
You know, I usually just do da bao. A new coffee shop opened across the road, the Hainanese curry rice. Not bad. Next time I bring for you.
Aye, girl, so unhealthy. How can you eat every day da bao?
Hui Bin paused, weighed her next words carefully. If Ma is at home, Ma can cook soup for you, steam fish like you like.
It's fine. I try to make congee myself since it's easy, and I eat a lot of fruit.
Eating hawker food every day is not good, even if you eat fruit.
Doreen stopped picking at the toast. The corners of her mouth were dark with coffee.
Hui Bin thought of the nun at her convent school who'd given out waxy packets of chocolate milk every day.
Drink up and show me those chocolate smiles, she'd say.
And Hui Bin would gulp down the powdery calcium supplement that she'd learned later in life, tasted nothing like real milk, but had found so delicious anyway.
Don't start this now,
a warning in Doreen's voice. But Hui Bin had to go on. She saw her daughter so rarely, she had to give it her best shot.
I get around okay with the walker now. My bedroom is just sitting empty, gathering dust. I would be very careful. You just have to leave the food and kitchen things where I can reach.
And the
physio sessions and your medication? I only do physio once a week now that my leg is better. You could take me. It's not more work than coming to visit. And I can take my medication myself. You just have to set it out each morning with some water. It's only the bottle lids I can't manage with my fingers, and the labels are too small to read. And the commode shower?
Hui Ben fell silent.
The plastic wheelchair with its open seat, the aged rubber-gloved hand sliding between the cheeks of her buttocks, sitting naked, placid as a cow.
No, she could not ask Doreen to do that.
They finished their drinks. Doreen left half a piece of toast behind, and Hui Bin did not have the heart to say, as she usually did, that one ought not to waste good food.
Look, Ma.
Just then, the woman at the next table let out a grating shriek. Doreen leaped to her feet, sending her stool clattering to the floor. Something large and dark scurried under the table. Others jumped up, too. Some whipped out their phones and pointed them toward the ground.
Get up, Ma, get up!
It was easy enough for Doreen to say. Hui Bin struggled to get to her feet, determined not to stumble or fall. She was strong, stronger than her daughter or anyone else would imagine. Everyone was still screaming, filming, threatening to call the Health and Sanitation Board or the police. Someone yelled, "This place should be shut down! Such disgusting pests coming straight from the kitchen!" And so on and so forth. Young people had never lived with rats. The creature was under Hui Bin's chair now. Slowly she got up, and now she was standing. Now she took hold of her walker. Doreen was gesturing frantically, her face so scrunched in fear it was laughable. Despite all Doreen's brusqueness, all the power she'd held over Hui Bin, she was, at her core, a little girl afraid of a rodent. It occurred to Hui Bin that she was wearing sandals, and it wouldn't be good for the rat to bite her. Yet, if she did get some disease and died that way, it would still be a better death than a slow decline in Sunrise Valley's high-dependency ward. Doreen was shouting for her to move.
"What's wrong with you, Ma? Move! Move!"
All this noise over a little rat. Then she felt it. The rodent's weight on her left foot, its sharp claws digging into her flesh as it moved, the feeling of warm, filthy fur on her skin. Screams and more screams, not from her, though. She had known rats in the dilapidated row house she'd lived in as a girl, had been woken up by the sound of their teeth chewing through thick gunny sacks to get to the rice, but never had one touched her. It was a sickening feeling. Then a quick, awful scuttling of the claws, and it was gone, a flash of black dashing out into the glitzy fluorescent lights of the mall.
"Are you okay?" Doreen said, grasping her mother's arm protectively.
Looking into her daughter's face, Hui Bin seemed to see her at every age, a little girl arranging colored pencils on the cold, tiled floor, a teenager briefly venturing into rebellion, short skirt, permed hair, a young woman in her first job, boxy jacket with shoulder pads, a lightness to her walk, as if all the world awaited, as if all the world were at her feet. And now here she was, middle-aged, overworked, childless, alone. To think that she'd imagined Doreen capable of saving her, moving out of Sunrise Valley would take her no further from death. What would happen to the rat? Hui Bin recalled the neighbor boy she played marbles with as a girl, who she'd thought had terrible aim but realized years later had been holding back on purpose to draw out the game. That boy was long dead, found with blood seeping from his nose and gums, bruises pooling in the crooks of his knees. For most families on their block, there were weeks when food ran short, and all a child might have to eat was some slices of sweet potato and watery congee. It was in such a week that the neighbor boy, empty stomach gnawing like an animal trying to get out of his body, had chanced upon a box of rat poison in the kitchen and mistaken it for food.
"Take me home," Hui Bin said to her daughter. Doreen, pale as a baby chick, drove carefully this time. Now, Hui Bin was the one who sat with people at mealtimes, and Kerpal, who was alone. Satvir had not come back to visit after his birthday. Hui Bin thought of her often, sitting in some air-conditioned conference room, with men whose paunches strained against their shirts, who stared at her long neck as she went, line by line, through whatever contract was under discussion. Beautiful Satvir, intelligent Satvir, well-meaning Satvir, whose Dadaji had once taken her to the beach. What emotion had moved her to contact the newspaper, take the day off, buy the balloons, request that Mrs. Tan hold the celebration in the big hall and not the rec room? What misguided pity, secret pride, warped vanity had made her chatter away to the reporter about Kerpal's past when he himself would say nothing? All that mattered for Satvir was the outside world, the world that would read the article in the Singapore Tribune the next morning and say, "How touching! How brave! What sacrifices a man like this must have made for our nation!" Impossible for her to imagine was the world of Sunwise Valley, where her mild, jovial grandfather, who had taken her to the beach, actually had friends. Friends he cared for. Friends with internal lives and moral compasses and hypocrisies of their own. Friends who had to sit next to him at lunch and think about what he had done. He had not intentionally kept it from him, Kerpal had explained. No one talked about their lives from before. That this was true did nothing to stop the residents of Sunrise Valley from peeling away from him, one by one. Nothing this exciting had happened since Madame Seat had been caught in bed with a male aide. "I just feel like we had a right to know," Cynthia said, every time the topic was discussed, which was every occasion that Kerpal was not there. "I just feel like we had a right to know." Low voice, lips pursed, she lived for the performance. "Know what?" Hui Bin wanted to ask. "What was there to know, and why should they have any right to know it at all?" But she kept her mouth shut. She had, after all, read the English headlines out loud to Al Gao and his crew that very first morning, aware, the entire time, of Kerpal's soft, unblinking eyes on her. The Singapore Tribune article was parsed over and over. Kerpal's unique ability to put prisoners at ease had often moved them to donate their organs before the end. It's just to stay healthy, he cracked a raw egg into his coffee each morning. A young prison officer, he had started out as an assistant to Mr. Gloucester, a British hangman in the colonial prison services, well-versed in the table of drops. Hui Bin was often enlisted to translate some English word or another, and there was no doubt that she was flattered by the attention. She was never alone now. The others had grown comfortable with her at last. And these days, even when the conversations had nothing to do with Kerpal, they included her out of habit. No one, really, was against the death penalty itself. "No use feeling sorry for them," Hosmi, the lawyer, said. "I've met these drug dealers. Trust me, you don't want them near your kids." Here Cynthia would shudder dramatically, wrap her bony fingers around her shoulders in a girlish manner that, a long time ago, might have been charming. "Someone must do law," Agu said matter-of-factly. "Otherwise, how to keep Singapore safe? But I-yo, something wrong with him. Do so for many years. So many people." The issue, then, was not the act of hanging itself, but the consistency and equanimity with which Kerpal had seemingly carried on for so long. And how did Hui Bin feel about it? If there was one thing that she had learned in her 82 years of life, it was that she could grow accustomed to anything, anything at all. It was still some months before Kerpal began to wake up with long scratches down the sides of his arms and no memory of how they had appeared. Some months before the aides would recommend mitts for what they called his night fidgets, a year before a bed jacket would be imposed, for anyone other than Kripal, mitts and jacket would come much sooner. But Kripal would wheedle the staff, charm Mrs. Tan, tease the aides. Once the residents would no longer have anything to do with him, he would turn his attention to his minders, direct all the cheers nature could muster toward them. Being human, they would not be immune. But they were professionals, and eventually, as Kripal continued to rake his fingers, nails into the thin flesh of his arms night after night, they would be left with no option but to move him to High D. For now, though, Kripal still sat in the dining room in his wheelchair, feeding himself, his limbs unencumbered. What was it that made Hui Bin rise from her table? Cynthia interrupted mid-sentence, shooting her a look of annoyance. Take her tray and cross the room to where Kripal sat. There was no one thing she could point to. Later, she would say that Kripal was taking on the faded look that Hazel had had before her precipitous decline. Curious, then, is my diarrhea, the weight of a rat's claws on her bare foot. He cracked a raw egg into his coffee each morning. When her car finally conked out, Doreen would take the MRT. My Dada G is a man with a rare gift. The neighbor boy lying pale with blood trickling from his nose. No one would save her. Hui Bin sat down. Kripal looked at her with his soft, soft eyes. When she spoke, it was as if to an old friend, someone she had played marbles with in the sticky caress of the monsoon morning, on a street that once held so many lives and families and children, but had long since ceased to exist. Tell me, she said, what's it like to die? Next, from the sporting scene section of the June 7, 2021 online edition of the New Yorker magazine, an ode to the no-hitter, It's How Baseball Should Be Played, by Paul Eli. Doc Ellis pitched a no-hitter while on LSD for the Pirates in 1970. Jim Abbott pitched one for the Yankees in 1993 with his mitt tucked under the stump of his missing right arm while he threw with his left. Bob Feller of the Indians pitched one on opening day in 1940. Don Larson of the Yankees pitched one against the Dodgers in the 1956 World Series. And the catcher, Yogi Berra, did what catchers do when a no-hitter is finally complete and logged into the record books. He raced toward the mound and leapt into the pitcher's outstretched arms. The no-hitter is normally a rarity. There were only 305 of them in the major leagues from 1876 to 2020. In 2021, however, the no-hitter is suddenly commonplace. In a typical season, there are two or three no-hitters. This year, there have been six, and the 162-game season is only two-fifths finished. When Corey Kluber of the Yankees pitched a no-hitter against the Rangers on Wednesday, May 19th, the response was elation laced with alarm. Spencer Turnbull of the Tigers had pitched a no-hitter against the Mariners the night before. Joe Musgrove of the Padres had pitched a no-hitter against those same Rangers back in April. Together, the six no-hitters were seen as an augury of baseball's future, a product of the qualities, repetition and efficiency of execution that are making it hard for the sport to draw new fans or keep longtime fans interested. There's truth to that, but it's not right to malign the no-no. The no-hitter is where baseball's preoccupation with statistics meets its love of lore, and it represents a path back from the data-driven extremes of the present. Like the home run, which can't be fielded because the ball leaves the playing field, the no-hitter is defined by what doesn't happen. It's a game with no singles, no doubles in the gap, no triple caroming in the corner, no home run hooking inside the foul pole and caught by a kid with a glove in the stands who holds the ball aloft as the ultimate souvenir. Nine innings pass, 27 outs are made, and no player on one team reaches base on a hit.
A player can reach on a walk, or if he's hit with a pitch, or if a fielder makes an error on a ball hit to him, and it's still a no-hitter. A game in which none of those things happen, and when nobody on one team reaches base at all, is called a perfect game. It's fair to see the 6 no-hitters this season as the culmination of trends that are spoiling the sport. Pitchers who study the weaknesses of hitters with huge data sets and reams of video. Pitchers swapped out by the manager after an inning or two in order to confound the hitters. Pitchers throwing 101 miles per hour, their arms fortified by surgery. Fielders acutely aware of where each player usually hits the ball, tabulated across thousands of at-bats. Hitters urged to swing with a high launch angle by coaches informed by statisticians who deem singles, bunts, and stolen bases less run productive than homers. Together, these trends have given pitchers a dominance over hitters such as they haven't had since 1968, when Detroit's Denny McClain won 31 games and St. Louis's Bob Gibson allowed just 1.12 runs per 9 innings. The league then lowered the pitcher's mound to reduce pitcher's advantage. Paradoxically, a short-term solution has compounded the problem, a dejuiced ball, which was introduced this year to decrease the number of home runs and keep the ball in play, has brought echoes of the dead ball era of a century ago. The trends are grim. A league batting average of .236, an average that used to be a ticket to the minor leagues. Teams making 17 of their 27 outs through strikeouts, swing and a miss, check swinging, caught looking. Games ending 1-0, 2-0, 6-0. Game after game in which it takes a long time for not much to happen. An era with a weekly no-hitter would represent baseball's full transition from a national pastime to the pursuit of specialists like contract bridge. And yet, for the time being, each individual no-hitter is still exciting. An uneventful game turns suspenseful as one team and generally one pitcher passes the 5th inning, the 6th, the 7th, without allowing a hit. Will somebody break it up with a clean single? Will some fielder blow it, misplaying a ball that is judged a hit rather than an error by a fickle official score? Will an umpire blow it, as happened in 2010, when Armando Galarga of the Tigers retired the first 26 Indians, and then the umpire, Jim Joyce, confoundingly called a batter safe at the first in the top of the 9th, although he was clearly out, and soon apologized to Galarga and all of baseball. The suspense of a no-hitter is compounded by the feeling, if you're following the game, that you're being drawn into history. What might be history if the guy on the mound can keep it up? You're about to witness a rare event? Maybe. You couldn't have guessed that it would be a no-hit night. Plenty of no-hitters have been thrown by unheralded pitchers, yet the Hall of Famers Steve Carlton and Pedro Martinez never threw one. Now it's happening, and you are in the middle of it. That has been my experience. During the game that Kluber was pitching, I was driving from Washington, D.C. to New York, along with my wife and our twin sons, so I listened to the Yankees-Rangers radio broadcast straight through, something I rarely do. The Yankees' 82-year-old broadcaster John Sterling coolly observed after 4 innings that the Rangers were hitless and expertly turned up the drama from there. We reached Brooklyn in the 8th and went up to our apartment where our youngest son was watching a Warriors-Lakers NBA play-in game. And so Kluber's no-no, no hits, 9 strikeouts, 1 walk, was set against the spectacle of Steph Curry and LeBron James making shots from great distances. What were the odds that the rare game I'd listened to straight through would be a no-hitter? About as extreme as the odds involved in the no-hitter my sons and I saw in person. On a rainy Friday in June 2012, we trekked out to Citi Field for a youth league field trip, Mets versus Cardinals, several hundred kids and parents seated in the upper deck. I hadn't been to a Mets game since 1974 when I was a kid myself.
Johan Santana, who was coming off shoulder surgery, took a no-hitter into the eighth. The Mets had never had a no-hitter in their 50-year history, more than 8,000 games. And the ushers, sensing the occasion, absorbed in the game themselves, seemed not to notice as the four of us descended to field level and stood near the $1,000 seats behind home plate as history was made. That no-hitter was a big night for Santana in more than one way, throwing 134 pitches, far more than usual, to complete the game. He likely strained his throwing arm. He struggled through the rest of the season and two failed comeback attempts in the seasons that followed. One Sunday in 1990, I wandered into a no-hitter so strange that I had to check my memory on the internet 3 decades later. I'd gone to Central Park to see David Byrne play a free concert at Summer Stage, but it was canceled when a thunderstorm came. I sought shelter at J.G. Mellon on 74th and 3rd, a place I'd never been. There, on a WPIX broadcast from Chicago, flickering on a TV in the corner, Andy Hawkins, pitching for the Yankees against the White Sox, allowed no hits through 8 innings, but lost 4-0, due to 3 errors and 4 walks because Chicago, as the home team with the lead, didn't bat in the ninth. He wasn't credited with a no-hitter, even though he'd pitched the full game. Most people who follow baseball have stories like those. We mark our history with the game from one no-hitter to the next. And as we do so, we mark a broader history. On one level, 2 no-hitters and 2 nights during a week in May made the no-hit game seem no big deal. On another, Kluber's no-hitter was the first Yankees no-hitter since won by David Cohn, a perfect game, in 1999. In the time between, John Sterling did play-by-play for more than 32,000 Yankee games. Bush beat Gore. The September 11th attacks were followed by the war in Afghanistan, America's longest war. Greta Thunberg was born, came of age, and trolled Donald Trump. Tom Brady, quarterbacked at Michigan, was picked by the Patriots in round 6 of the NFL draft, and had the first 21 years of his epochal career. It's a truism that baseball is history by analogy. But will that history be of any interest to the next generation of fans if individual games are lacking in dramatic action? The short answer is no. Too many games now are too long and too dull, spoiled by substitutions, warm-up pitches, timeouts, commercial breaks, and video reviews of close plays. Practices the league's executives have come under pressure to revise. But the qualities that characterize a no-hitter are the qualities that baseball ought to recover and enhance, not do away with. Most obviously, the prospect of a no-hitter forces players and managers to focus on the game at hand. With history and publicity in mind, the manager whose pitcher is mid-no-hitter will set aside the chart, the data-driven impulse to take the pitcher out in order to keep him fresh for his next outing, or to replace him with a pitcher who has better matchups against opposing hitters based on past performance or what side of the plate they swing from. In this way, the no-hitter is a triumph of common sense. Look, our pitcher is throwing incredibly well tonight, so let's leave him in the game. An imminent no-hitter also drives fielders to make risky, exciting plays, the way Tyler Wade, a utility infielder forced to play right field after a teammate's injury during Kluber's game, raced to catch a line drive in the ninth inning that he might have let drop for a single on another night. On the flip side, a pitcher's dominance ought to prompt the other team to try to break up his no-hitter through strategies as old as the game, by bunting unexpectedly for a base hit, say, or by getting on base with a walk and rattling the pitcher by taking extra long lead and threatening to steal a base. As it develops, a no-hitter also encapsulates the best qualities of a night at the park or a game followed on TV or radio. The sport's structural focus on the pitcher, who begins every play in every game, is made a mise-en-scene with the diamond and the stadium framing the mound where something truly exceptional is happening. The game moves briskly, without tedious changes of pitchers and consultations on the mound. And in the sport's pitching dominant moment, a no-hitter is also, as often as not, a close game. The night Kluber threw his no-hitter, the Rangers pitcher Haiyang Jong Yang stymied the Yankees too, allowing only 3 hits through 5 innings. As he strove for a no-no, Kluber had to hold a 2-0 lead. A no-hitter is intense. You don't want to leave your seat or change a channel in the 8th and miss the hit that turns a no-hitter into just another game. Common or uncommon, the no-hitter, no matter what statisticians say, is a humiliating experience for the team that falters at the plate. It turns professional hitters into little leaguers, man boys who can't do the one thing they've given their best years to doing, who can't hit them where they ain't, as Wee Willie Keeler, a star of the dead ball era, explained the essence of the game. An ego-shriveling, weakly no-hitter might lead batters and managers to stop waiting for baseball's executives to make structural changes to the game, and prompt them rather to make changes themselves by doing the things at the plate: drag bunts, slap hits, hits and runs, hits to the opposite field, hits against the defensive shift, that have made baseball exciting for 100 years. It might force them to stop playing the percentages and simply play ball again. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, that's 919-832-5138. Well, thank you for listening to North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.